All right, looks like we are building a file, which is really what we need to do when we do a podcast.
Yes, it is. And hi, folks. Welcome to the June Mike and Scotty Live. We've got a number of interesting and unusual topics this month, not the least of which is our extensive tour of the Grafton and Upton Railroad that we have been promising for years and years and years. I saw the Seaview Railroad today, and Mike is going to talk about his basement expansion that he touched upon a little bit last month. So, Mike, why don't we hit the ground running with the Grafton and Upton? Kevin, and what was Kevin's last name? I guess I should ask.
Kevin Gallagher, and
Kevin Gallagher. I knew that.
he
I
is the
knew.
busiest man in New England, I think, because he's got a full-time job. He's an engineer on the weekends, plus he's got his own custom painting business.
Yeah, so Kevin Gallagher, who actually Mike and I kind of met kind of sort of many years ago when we initially walked the property at the Grafton and Upton, and he was there that particular Saturday working on a locomotive, and we just happened to ask him in passing if it was all right if we looked around, and he gave us his blessing, and lo and behold, 5 or 6 years later, I'm not exactly sure how long ago it was. He was gracious enough to give us a guided tour of the hot spots along the right of way.
Even stranger, in between those two things, probably a couple of years after we had the chance encounter with him at the GNU that first time, I get a call from him, and he is looking to have me do a sound install on one of his locomotives. So at the time, I didn't know who it was, and we had a phone conversation. He mentioned he worked for the Grafton and Upton. And we started to converse a little bit, and all of a sudden I realized this has got to be the guy that we ran into that day. And what are the odds of that, right?
Kevin was gracious enough to take time out of his busy Saturday schedule. And what a nice guy, Mike.
Really, really nice guy. And I was very impressed, I think, as I always am when I speak with him, at the depth of his knowledge. You know what I mean? He's one of those guys that really knows the subject. And again, well, he'd been, I guess, working with the GNU for, what did he say, 10 years?
10 years, he said. He started working there when John Della Priscoli resuscitated the line.
Right. And you can learn a lot in 10 years, and he's obviously a very bright guy.
Yeah, well, and you know, he just to get back to the level of hospitality we received. I mean, he certainly didn't owe us anything, and he didn't even really know that this was for podcast fodder.
Right, he's not a podcaster.
Yeah, he didn't even really know what a podcast was.
What did he say? He said, podcasts to him are like smartphones to me.
Yeah, exactly. And yeah, so so we met Kevin in North Grafton, not very far from the North Grafton yard, which is the northern terminus of the railroad. And so we caravaned over there and got a chance to walk around the facility, but more importantly, Kevin knows where the bodies are buried, and he
You have
had
to
a
explain
story.
that one.
Well, I mean, he had a story to tell about every piece of equipment that was there, every
True.
locomotive, what was right with it, what was wrong with it, what its origin was, and there's some eclectic equipment there.
And I think he personally painted most of them with some help.
Well, I mean, he worked on them to get them running. He painted them. Grafton Upton has its own distinctive paint scheme, and he's really the only. He said the only thing that he hasn't done and he refuses to do is swing a track hammer.
Right. So he's a, like I said, a very intelligent guy.
So, Mike, if your memory doesn't fail you, tell us a little bit about some of the locomotives we saw.
Well, I think the first thing I noticed before we even get to the locomotives was how different the whole place looked, right? When we went there, it looked like they were just sort of putting down some of the tracks, or maybe rebuilding some of the tracks there. And when we got there, the other day, it looked like a bustling concern. There were all these different locomotives. I certainly don't remember all of them, but there was a Topeka cab Jeep. There was a Slug. There was a CF7. There was an XCN Jeep 9, chop nose Jeep 9,
Yep.
and there was
There
only
was
one.
another Jeep 9.
And then, of course, there was the lease unit, the GATX lease unit, which was an MP15, and he was telling us how that's an it was born as a Milwaukee road unit. And remember, he took us around to the engineer side of it there, and they had removed the all-weather window because it's not really what you need up our way. And you could see the Milwaukee orange paint, which was underneath, where the all-weather window had been. So, really kind of amazing.
Well, and the thing about, and again, this is where, a guided tour makes all the difference in the world. If you would ask me how old that locomotive was, I'd say about 10 years.
Yeah, it didn't. Well, I mean, I happen to know when they stopped making MP15s, but you would never be able to tell by the condition of it. I mean, it really, and that was true of all the GNU equipment. All of it was spiffy, well maintained, no discernible visible rust or anything, no peeling paint. The whole place just has a well-run operation look to it, I thought.
Yeah, really does. So the reason for this, folks, if you haven't been following along closely with the discussions over the last few years regarding the GNU, is that, and I think Mike's got a really good sense of this now, is that my claim is that this is a railroad that would make a perfect model. It has everything, and Mike brought up a good point Saturday in that. You could date this for any period you want and be accurate.
Well, it has a very long and storied history, and
Sure.
that was we were having a conversation about that in what was that, Hopedale?
Hopedale, yeah.
He was pointing out, and apparently you knew this too, that what was that large manufacturing concern in that town?
Draper Mills.
Draper Mills, right? So that was kind of, I guess, really the reason for being of the short line at that time, and it was electrified.
Yeah,
It was an
yeah.
electric short line, and I guess the whole length of it was electrified.
It was. It started out as a steam railroad, and very shortly after they opened, they electrified and ran a couple of steeple cabs. They did run passenger service, which amounted to, I believe, a combine. Draper was such a huge industry and employed so many people in the area that literally the railroad existed and was owned by Draper at one point to serve the mill and its employees
Which is not uncommon, US Steel owned all kinds of short lines.
sure, yeah. This was, I wouldn't call it a thriving operation per se. It probably at best broke even, but under the auspices of the Draper Mill and the owners of that business, they probably wrote it off if it ever operated at a loss.
Well, I was struck by the sheer size of the Draper operation. I know a lot of it has been knocked down, but even what's left of it still standing, there was a sign out front saying, space release. It was 500,000 square feet. That's a lot of square feet. That's quite a few Home Depots.
And I would say that probably that represents about 25% of the original facility, or the facility at its peak.
Incredible.
Yeah, well, and for those that don't know, and there's probably many of you, Draper was the largest manufacturer of textile looms at the time. They were considered kind of the Cadillac, if you will, of that type of machine, and they were shipped all over the world. So, this was a big outfit.
And didn't you
In
say
the
Berkshire Hathaway ended up buying them out at one
I
point?
understand, I believe that Berkshire Hathaway
Yeah.
bought them out at one point. Yeah.
Speaking of big outfits.
So getting back to now, we're talking about Hopedale, which is the southern terminus of the railroad, but we'll head back to Grafton because the other kind of novelty, if you will, of that North Grafton yard is the propane gas unloading facility that's about to go online. That's been the cause of a great deal of controversy for the townsfolk who don't want anything like that in their backyard. And literally, in some cases, it is in people's backyard. But it just goes to show the kind of creativity that the owner of the railroad has in bringing industry into the area.
Well, when I had been following this online, all of this, all of these protests and what have you, I had not seen the propane facility in person because that was nothing but either a big field or woods when we were up there. And so I didn't really have like a good picture of it in my mind. But to be honest with you, the way people were talking about it, I expected it to be smack dab in the middle of a neighborhood, and that's not really how it hit me. The one house that I saw near it, that's Grafton and Upton's office. I didn't see any other houses really that were like directly adjacent to it. So right away I just thought, so what's the big deal here? But I was also very impressed with just how, it looked very professionally done and just, everything done right to the max in terms of the quality of construction and the way it's laid out and all of that. It just looks like, again, a first-class operation.
And a lot of that has to, a lot of that has to do with just the practice of installing this type of facility. But there's been so much incredible scrutiny by the town and their lawyers, and it's dragged out in courts and every step of the way, every process that was filed on behalf of the town was shot down, and it ended up costing the town millions and millions of dollars for something that they had absolutely no chance to win, and were told so very early on in the litigation. They pursued it to that end.
Well, not that I'm an expert on propane facilities, although in another life, when I was like 21, I did work for a propane distributor. But I have to say, just from what I saw, everything looked like it was done first class with no corners cut whatsoever. And that basically, that's just how they do things there, it looks like.
Now, my understanding was that you did that until you just ran out of gas.
Very good.
And again, just so people kind of get a mental image of what's going on here, the CSX mainline, the old Boston and Albany mainline, runs perpendicular to the Grafton and Upton. The Grafton and Upton kind of forms a T into it, if you will, and that's where CSX interchanges traffic. They do it, according to Kevin, in the middle of the night when everybody's asleep. And I'm sure those few houses that are on that side street that lead to the yard, those people must absolutely love it.
Yeah, although when you think about it, if you've got freight trains going by on the B&A all the time, how different is that going to be for them, really? Because the B&A is not just a daytime operation either.
Well, I would say that the
There's
difference
not like there's
between.
crossings to blow there, are there? Well, I guess they'd blow crossing the street going into the yard, wouldn't they?
Well, think about the banging of couplers and air brakes and all that sort of thing, and the taking up of slack. And remember too that main line, as it leaves the North Grafton Yard, is on a little bit of a grade. So, you're going to be hitting that slack hard when those locomotives peel off to go up the hill to go back to the main line.
It's too bad it's in the middle of the night like that because it would be kind of a cool thing to see how they switch it out.
Absolutely.
The other
Absolutely.
thing that we saw there, not to cut you short on the propane
No.
end of it, but there were just a slew of what looked like plastics covered hoppers, the 4 bay type, and it looked like two different kinds of Trinity covered hoppers there. So I asked Kevin about that because I wasn't aware of any large plastics facility nearby, and he told us that they had upwards of 80 of those stored empty on site, but that they were there to shuttle back and forth from, I guess, Canada and some other places up north, where they were
Yes.
getting wood pellets.
Yep.
Now, if you recall, when we were down last time, that wood pellet facility, which was in Upton, right?
West Upton, yeah.
West Upton. That was they were just putting that together at that time. We kind of walked around the site where they were beginning to assemble the silos and all of that. So all of that was very much undone at that time. And now, of
It
course,
kind of looked like a full-scale Walther's kit.
it really did. I mean, you could it's the same kind of parts, just heavy.
Yeah.
And but when I looked at the sheer quantity of freight cars there, I started an interrogatory with them about what kind of volume we were talking about. So I guess this facility is one giant Consignee down there. And I guess if I don't know if you're done with Grafton, but
Yeah.
just talking about West Upton there, we could probably spend some time on, because that surprised me too.
Well, West Upton was is the center of the railroad, and as such, in its previous heyday, which was nothing in comparison to today, because it's a real going concern right now. That's where their engine facilities were. We saw the maintenance pit, if you will.
Right.
We saw the remnants of an old coal and grain dealer
Right.
that existed on the property. But just touching back to our original visit, Mike, we referred to that area as the surface of the moon because it
Right.
was just this incredible open wound construction project. And the transloading facility that's there at that time, I don't know, it might have had a dozen cars in it.
Well, it looked nothing like what we saw, that's for sure.
Right. And when we were there Saturday, I'm guessing there had to be a minimum of 40 and maybe 60 tank cars in there.
Easily.
Yeah.
And Kevin was telling us that they're going to be adding tracks in there.
Yeah, he said they were going to add 14 additional tracks.
So to explain what they're doing there, they bring in all kinds of different commodities in tank cars. And then these various commodities are transloaded to trucks to go to industries all over the place. So this is sort of a central location that they bring all the chemicals in from long distance by rail in much larger quantities than just sending a fleet of trucks over the road, and then it's dispatched by commodity as needed. But there, if you saw 60 tank cars there, there might have been 40 commodities that they were unloading.
Well, and it was pointed out to us that for all of the hullabaloo over the propane facility, that people had really kind of turned a blind eye to some of the contents of those tank cars in West Upton,
Right.
and in fact, they may ha if they knew exactly what was in them, they may be a little more concerned than four brand new, highly regulated propane tanks.
Right. Although these commodities are going down the B&A all day, every day.
Yeah.
And honestly, railroad tank cars are the safest way to ship any hazardous commodity like that.
Well, of course they are, but people who don't know any better, when they see the words sulfuric acid on the side of a tank car, tend to get a little nervous.
Well, don't get me wrong. If there was ever a derailment involving hazmat tank cars, I'm moving the other way. I mean,
Yeah, no,
there's
I
no
you
question about that.
yeah, you hope for a full tank of gas in your car
Yep.
and you get the hell out of Dodge. But be that as it may, they have a great safety record, as do any railroad for moving that stuff on over the line. But the other piece regarding, so two additional points about West Upton. Like, the first is that I had said to you, and I knew you kind of didn't have a sense because it was just overwhelming, but I'd said to you a couple of times, hey, wait till you see the pallets of wood pellets.
Right.
And I'll let you describe what that scene kind of looked like.
Well, but what I saw were there had to be, without exaggeration, thousands of pallets of bagged wood pellets. And to make it even more impressive, basically this is the time of year when they quote unquote don't have many laying around. So if we were to be there in, let's say, September or October, there would be, three times as many. So it's quantities of product moving around in a fashion that just defies imagination. This whole facility unloads the pellets from covered hoppers into two large storage silo bins next to the facility, and then, as needed, these pellets are piped into the facility to be bagged and put on pallets. And then, I guess, in the busy season, it's a parade of forklifts that are running these things back and forth out of the building and piling them up and loading them into trucks to be transported to that other field farther up behind the transload area for the tank cars. And apparently, one man runs the whole facility in terms of the transferring and bagging and all that. That's the degree of automation that's involved in getting these pellets from tank car, I'm sorry, from covered hopper to storage bin to bags and onto the pallets. Amazing.
So you've got those two facilities, if you will, within the confines of this West Upton complex. Now, the last piece that of interest to us there was the last locomotive we saw, which was an F7, and
Oh, I forgot about that. Yes.
in and of itself, just the fact that you got to see an F7. Still on its wheels and, not in a museum or not cut up somewhere is a novelty in
Right,
and of itself.
and looking like an actual F7, not having been all highly modified.
No, it was a, a true F7. It's a dummy unit right now. Actually, it's a boat anchor right now, I think is probably the way Kevin described it, but it unfortunately does not run. And I said to him, I thought I had seen it run within the last year. And he said, no, it's been about 3 years since it's run,
That's the
which
one with
is,
a crankshaft problem, I
yeah,
think.
it's got a crankshaft problem. Yeah, he said it was mechanical. And it's, and it was no, is, and it just goes to show. Now, here's the difference between a model railroader slash rail fan and a locomotive engineer. We're standing there like, wow, man, you should get this thing running. This will be great. And he's like, yeah, nobody likes running this thing because there's no rear view
Yeah,
whatsoever.
not much for switching.
No. And when you think about it, on a short line like the Grafton and Upton, where there are no through trains, there's no passenger service,
Right.
there's nothing moving over 10 miles an hour because that's the speed restriction on the line.
Right.
The last thing you want to be in is a locomotive where, you literally have to sit backwards in your seat and run the train from behind your back.
Yeah, the only application in modern times for something like that would either be for a business train or for some little I don't mean commuter, but you know what I mean. Why am I drawing a blank? What's the term for that? Like a touristy kind of line, and they do that on the Reading and Northern and what have you, but there's just no way the GNU has enough of a run to get any interest in that, I don't think.
Well, at this point, so save that, hold that thought. Now, when I had seen it operating, I don't think I ever saw it as the head end unit. It
Right.
was MU'd, probably, the third unit back.
Yeah, it was just power.
Yeah, it was just power. And as Kevin explained, that the grade from the North Grafton Yard up to Grafton Center, which is about 4 miles, is a 3.1% grade.
Is that what he said? That's a very steep grade.
It's a very steep grade, yeah. And so he said, they needed those locomotives to run MU'd in order to pull the freight trains up the hill.
Right.
And now with with basically just one locomotive in service, they've got to split the train in half in order to get it up the hill, which adds considerable time to the day.
Especially at 10 miles an hour.
To do any work. Well, he said it's a 12-hour day to go to Hopedale and back.
Think about that.
And then, you know, what they've been doing.
We drove it in like 10 minutes.
Yeah, and what they've been doing is actually kind of splitting the work. So, you know, 3 or 4 days a week they do the whole run, and then maybe 1 or 2 days a week they're only doing going to West Upton and back.
Sure.
So it's costing them some money to have locomotives out of service.
At Hopedale, we saw at least 4 or 5 full center beam flats of sheetrock, drywall.
Yeah, there were 4 loads there, and that was Saturday.
And a couple of empties, I think.
And a couple of empties. On Wednesday, there were 8 loads and 8 empties there.
Wow.
So, so that the...
Those are heavy cars, too.
They are heavy cars. And there's an interesting story about how they switched those cars, but just so folks get a snapshot of what's going on in the southern terminus, which is Hopedale, there is a plywood, sheetrock, lumber transfer facility, warehouse type of building. And it's a huge corrugated building. It's got to be, you know, the equivalent of 3 or 4 stories high and probably a couple of hundred feet long anyway.
Sure.
And basically, you know, they pull these center beam flat cars up to one end of it and fill tractor trailers out of the other end. And again, it's an all day, every day process of, you know, just moving loads out. Like a lot of the railroad, and especially the two ends, the north and the south, they're on pretty steep grades. And you can see when you're standing in the Hopedale yard, you can see the grade coming down the hill from the north. And Kevin explained that the process is almost like a hump yard.
Right.
Except without retarders. So they're cutting those cars off and letting them roll down the hill into the siding. And I guess they've got it down to a fine art where they know exactly, you know, how fast they're going and when they cut the cars, how far they're going to roll.
How else would you do it without a runaround, right?
Well, and that's the thing.
You'd have to shove these cars all the way down from West Upton?
Yeah. Yeah, there's no runaround track really anywhere on the line.
Are there grade crossings between Hopedale and West Upton?
There's plenty of them. In fact, there are 3 or 4 just north of the Hopedale yard.
So it would be very problematic to try to shove all that way.
Oh, well, it would be. The fact that it's a 10-mile-an-hour restriction probably helps a little bit.
True.
But I would suspect at some point they're going to have a runner. They're going to have to put some passing sidings in there because otherwise.
Hopedale hit me as a sort of a work in process kind of a place with a lot of potential.
Well, it's a big wide open area.
Right.
And
lots of real estate and it really just comes down to the pace of locating Consignees on the line, which it seems to be he's doing a really good job at.
Well, and Kevin pointed out, and of course it was pure speculation, that John Della Prescoli, the owner of the railroad, is the kind of guy that if he wants to do something, he does it. And he's proven that to this point.
Sure.
He's resurrected a railroad that no one ever would have bet would have run again. He's brought industry online. He's got to be turning a profit. There's just too many cars on this railroad to not be.
Think of the difference in activity we saw from the first visit to this visit.
Yeah. Oh yeah. Crazy. Yeah. So he's there was speculation that he may buy that Draper facility, and if that happens, you can bet there's going to be a pretty neat industrial park that goes in there, and there's plenty of room for that.
Well, the way to do it is to, and I'm sure this is his modus operandi. You know, you get your ducks in a row, you line up your potential consignees, you work your deals with the town, and you know, that permits you to do the kind of ambitious things that he's doing there.
Yep, absolutely. So Hopedale, the southern end of the railroad, actually is not supposed to be the southern end of the railroad. The railroad is supposed to go a few more miles into Milford and interchange with the CSX there. The problem with that is that it creates a little bit of redundancy, more so for the CSX. It would be of benefit to the Grafton and Upton to be able to interchange there, because it would save all of that trouble of bringing those center spine flat cars from North Grafton 15 miles away, where, you know, they could just pull them 3 or 4 miles away if it's even that far, you know, and interchange them that way. But the difference is that the line, the CSX freight line from Franklin to Milford is about a 1 day a week run for the CSX. There are only two or three industries on that line, and CSX just does not want to have to commit to the level of activity that the Grafton and Upton would need them to do to create that interchange point and make it viable for the GNU. So again, you know, pure speculation, but the thought that was conveyed to us was that Grafton Upton may end up buying that stretch of railroad, which would about double its length, but it would certainly end that problem that the GNU has of how to get the CSX to do what it needs it to do, and, you know, how to make its workload easier by not having to move those cars so far over some pretty rough track.
So in that circumstance, where would the connection with CSX move to?
Well, and again,
Franklin?
Again, pure speculation, but there is, my guess is Franklin, and there are two lines, if you will, that come into Franklin. One was the original Midland route, which actually dead ends in Franklin now. But there's enough track there. There's probably about 3 miles of track there that could be used as a yard or an interchange point. So, you know, I could see the Grafton and Upton coming into Franklin and then backing down onto that former main line, you know, leaving its cars there, you know, picking up, you know, its loads, and then taking off back to Milford and Hopedale.
And that was your old hangout as a kid, right?
Yeah. So, you know, I grew up in Franklin, and I'm obviously incredibly familiar with that particular area. We were talking about, when we were kind of shooting the breeze in Hopedale, that when I was a kid, I used to ride on the freight train in the summers from Franklin to Milford every day. So, you know, back then it was an everyday job. Now, like I say, it's, you know, maybe once, twice a week at the most. But, you know, I think, and again, I think if the Grafton and Upton owned that trackage, I think you would see a lot more industry come in there.
All right, so we're going to cast two votes in favor of that.
Yeah, you know, you'd have to, as a model railroader, as a rail fan, you'd have to be nuts to not want to see that happen. As far as I know, there are three industries there. There is a cogeneration plant, which is relatively new. There is a dairy, and there is a glass bottle making plant.
Interesting.
Yeah. So, and the, you know, that's spread out from Franklin to Milford, which is about probably 10 miles of track altogether. So, and there's just an absolute ton of opportunity for industry along that line. So we'll see.
Well, it was. I expected it to be a good day, and actually, I had even more fun than I thought I would. It was more interesting than I thought it would because I couldn't really envision just how much had changed since the last time we were there. So it was definitely time well spent, and I want to thank Kevin for being so gracious to devote a good portion of his Saturday to guiding us around and just being so forthcoming with all the information. It was great.
Yeah, it was nice and it was helpful, and it certainly we wouldn't have been able to tell this story without him.
That's true.
We would have just said, yeah, we had a great time, we saw a lot of stuff, and that was about it.
And most of what we're relating here, he told us.
So blame him. So having said that, one of the things that he mentioned to us were that these locomotives that aren't running are going to this facility, this locomotive repair facility in North Kingstown, Rhode Island, called Seaview, which is kind of the default location for a lot of the local area railroads to send their equipment for repair.
And by coincidence,
And by coincidence, I happened to be down there today for another reason entirely. But be that as it
I've
may,
only
I
seen it from the train going by, the passenger train going
Yeah.
by. So I'd be interested in, how much of it you actually got to see, how much of it's visible from public property and that kind of thing.
Well, there's quite a bit of it that's visible from public property. And had I had more time, I was down there on business, and unfortunately, I needed to attend an appointment and then get back to my office. I didn't get a chance to really kind of scout it out, but as I was driving into this facility, which was an old naval air base that they've turned into an industrial park, the first thing I saw was an MBTA commuter rail train that was sitting there being repaired. And I thought and it didn't dawn on me at first where I was and what I was seeing. And I thought, gee, I know the commuter rail doesn't come down this far. What's that train doing here? And then the next locomotive I saw was an SW78.
How many stacks did it have?
Had two.
So it's not an eight.
Okay, it might have been a seven then.
Okay, or might have been a 1500. Was it that new?
No, it was not. It was definitely not a 1500.
Okay.
That I could have told, but some of the other two stack ones, they all, sometimes it's just a matter of horsepower and louvers.
Yeah, the seven is an easy one to pick out because it has a what they call the letterboard gap between the louvers. It's the only EMD that, to my knowledge, that's like that as a as an end cab switcher. So you have, a pretty good stack of louvers going across on the doors, and then a space where you'd put the lettering, like Pennsylvania Railroad, and then more louvers right above that.
Well, this was lettered for Seaview, so that told me where I was in a fast hurry. That put it all in perspective to me. And so he was moving some cars around. He was working, and then right behind him was a 70 tonner.
Really?
Yeah, and that really surprised me. I almost drove off the damn road. And I'm looking at the watch, I'm looking at the clock in my car, and I'm, seeing if I have time to pull over, and unfortunately I didn't. And he was moving too.
The 70 tonner was in use?
It was in use.
So they have more than one loco switching things out there.
Yeah. Well, they had a lot of stuff in there. Now I don't know what was in there for repair, what part of that might be a yard for that industrial park, because there were a ton of covered hoppers in there.
Yep.
So I don't know, if and now I'm going to have to go kind of investigate Seaview a little bit, because I don't know if their only purpose is as a locomotive repair facility.
No, 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 no. That's, in fact, I think that came second.
Okay, so they're responsible for the switching of that
Yeah, think of it
box.
as like a fairly new, almost like an industrial park, if you will.
Yep. All right, so hey, I know where our next field trip's going to be then.
That's not a bad idea. I'll have to reach out and see if I can find somebody else I paint engines for.
Yep.
Or do sound installs for. Kevin's the painter.
Yep. So I thought, that was kind of an ironic twist to a great day Saturday that, I actually got to see something that he had talked quite a bit about, and something that's very important to the future of those Grafton Upton locomotives.
That is interesting. I was just talking to another buddy of mine who works for the T, and he had mentioned that the work is being done down there. So all of this is sort of like new information.
Yep.
At least to us.
Yeah. Yep. So getting away from that and getting back to the models.
Speaking of new information.
New information. So, hey, last month you dropped a 500-pound bomb on our heads. I didn't think you had any more surprise. I was going to nickname you the mundane micros.
Oh, gee.
You know, after, you know, layout kaboom. But, you know, this was a bunker buster.
I've got a couple of tricks up my sleeve here.
So, you know, last month you began the discussion about the potential of adding on to your house for the sole purpose of your wife giving you your own separate living quarters, because I'm kidding, folks. So one of the things that you had mentioned was that you had an appointment set up with someone who was going to come in with a drone.
Well, right. I had gotten to the point in the project where there was enough speculation, and a buddy of mine who used to be a builder and had basically said, yeah, this is viable, but, you know, you're now at the point really where you need to talk to an architect, somebody whose job is to figure things like this out. And I asked him if he had a recommendation, having been a contractor, and he says, matter of fact, I do. So I ended up contacting the fellow and had a real nice conversation with him, and it was pretty obvious that I had the right guy. And as a starting point, what he said he was going to do was come out with his drone so that he could get some aerial pictures of the site. And one of the reasons that's indicated here is that basically I'm joining two buildings. I'm joining my house, on the side of which is a walkout basement. So you walk out of my basement and you're on ground level. You're on my lower driveway. And I'm connecting from that wall of the house to my workshop and office building, which is next door, but it's at, you know, sort of a 45 degree angle to my house, but not even a 45 degree angle, you know, kind of a weird angle. So it was defying all of my efforts to figure out how the heck you actually do that, how the roof lines would go and how it would connect and exactly what kind of a footprint that I could get out of it. And, you know, all the million questions that you'd have about doing a project like this. And if you're going to go to the mat on this, if you're going to go through all of this, you want to make sure that what you end up with is enough space to justify the effort. So I did a lot of, you know, pacing around the driveway, chalk marks, you know, I was out there at night with a laser level trying to get some lines figured out, and basically I had concluded that if I could do what I wanted to do, that I would have enough space to make it worthwhile. So the reason he wanted to take the drone shots was so that he could get some very good pictures, because there's no real site plan showing both buildings on the lot, you know, lacking a topographical survey or something like that. And, you know, what we don't want to do is, when we go for a building permit here, what we don't want to do is give the kind of plan detail like you'd use if you were building the space shuttle. You know what I mean? It's a lot of the times when you're doing these things, the less said, the better, because what you want to do is you want to reserve the right to be flexible as things come up during the building process, and not have to always be going back for permission to do this, permission to do that. So even when I built this other building, you know, I went down to the town just to see what they had for plans, because, you know, it's 20-something years ago. I couldn't remember what we did. And it was basically a line drawing that I did on a sheet of paper. That's it.
Wow.
So I didn't even have a site plan, you know, for that building. So that's, you know, I'd like to be closer to that approach with this than not. Just so it doesn't get overly formal, because the more formal you get with it, the more you're paying your professionals, right? So that's not buying me more square footage for the layout.
No, not at all.
So he showed up, and I was already impressed with the guy as a smart dude. But not only does he know his stuff from an architectural standpoint, but boy, he can fly that drone. He launched it from my driveway, and of course, you see drone pictures, but I knew nothing about them really. It's like a whole different category of hobby. But as he was telling me, his is a pretty sophisticated one. It doesn't look like a bargain basement drone. It came in this beautiful hard case with all of these cutouts for all the parts, and there was a controller, a little computer tablet that kind of fit into it and acted as the monitor, the drone itself, and all he did was put the four propeller blades on it, on the four corners of it, and a little GoPro camera that, it like the size of a small apple, but squared off, really like really small. Actually, probably looked like your typical wall wart transformer that you'd plug in, your power supply. That's how big the GoPro was. And I'm looking at it and I'm thinking, what kind of video are we going to get out of this? Well, he powered this thing up, and it sounds like a giant hornet, you know what I mean? Or a giant electric razor, because it's four electric motors. And he says, now watch, it's trying to acquire satellites. The thing runs on GPS. And I guess there's 11 possible satellites you can get. And it won't take off until it gets at least five.
Jeez.
And they're so confident of the drone's ability to not get lost that if it ever does, the company will replace it. They'll give you
So
another one.
this is not a $60 toy.
I don't think so. When this thing goes up, if it loses radio contact, it realizes that and goes back to base and lands within 3 feet of its departure point automatically.
Come on.
Seriously. So he launches this thing, and because I have a lot of tall trees too, so he was trying to not run afoul of them. And I think he was probably about maybe 75, 85 feet in the air. And I'm looking at the tablet on his little control there. And the video was astonishing. It was crystal clear, completely detailed, like just amazing. I can't wait till he sends me the photos. And it's a view of your house. I mean, you can look at your house from, Bing or Google Maps from satellite. And I did actually have the opportunity to fly over my house many moons ago in a light plane and take a few blurry shots out of the through the window. But this was completely different. This is just completely perfect views of your house in ways that you'd never see, crystal clear out of this miniature GoPro camera. I was very seriously impressed.
So what do you hope to get from those pictures?
The pictures will enable them to lay out the existing building footprints on a plot plan. And then I guess the next thing they're going to do, he said he was going to send one of his people out to get the measurements of the buildings relative to one another. As he put it, shoot the angles or something like that. It's probably something done with tripods and math, So
What's
I
that?
can grasp the tripod, but I have a feeling what they're doing with math is a bit beyond what I normally do. You see surveyors out and things like that, and they're doing things very precisely with non-digital instruments like they've been doing it for a long time, and I have a feeling some of that's going to come into play here. That'll enable them to do a preliminary design. And the preliminary design will be, I guess, a line drawing in 3D. And they do everything on computer now, so I mean that'll be kind of interesting too. I have a feeling that if there are changes to be made, I can probably work with them to make these changes almost in real time, believe it or not. What we want to end up with is this preliminary design that I can then talk to my desired contractor on and make sure that I'm within my desired budget. And if I am, and we like the design, then we go to the final plan, submit it to the town, do my whole order of conditions thing for the because we're in the buffer zone, having a pond on the property. So basically, everything you do, you know, you have to. It's actually a state requirement, but you do it through the town. You submit it to the Conservation Commission, and they give you what's called an order of conditions, and they say, all right, you can do this, and here's how we want you to do it. You know, we want the contour to look like this, we want the drainage to be in this direction, we want it to have a drainage swale with riprap in it to slow down the flow of water, we want a hay bale check dam at the bottom of your slope to keep silt from the construction project out of the wetlands. You know, it's that kind of thing.
Yeah.
And that's what I had to do when I built the house, so I'm not unfamiliar with that. And I've already had the Conservation Commission come out and flag the wetlands, and they've actually moved away from the house some since I built the house, which is nice. So it means we're not going to be, although we're in the buffer zone, we're not going to be hard up against any buffer zone wetlands boundaries, and you're not allowed to go, you know, 1 inch into the wetlands, you know, where that boundary is set. So I don't have any issues there. I spoke to the conservation guy and explained that basically we're just replacing driveway area with two walls and a roof. I keep calling it two walls and a roof. How complicated can it be? And he didn't think we'd have any difficulty with it, which is what caused me to move ahead and do this thing with the architect. So we're officially at the spending money on it stage of the operation. And although I suppose there's still a chance that if some big uh-oh or gotcha comes up that it couldn't happen, I still think the odds are better that it's going to happen.
So what kind of time frame are we looking at?
Well, you know, I think my contractor has availability in the fall. So if the contractor and the foundation guy can sync it up before the winter really sets in, and if we can do all of our town stuff, let's say during, I don't know, maybe July, but certainly August, it kind of puts us on track for a mid-fall to late fall begin construction. And this should really not be a months long construction process. I mean, I really think they could do this in 2 to 3 weeks. It's two walls and a roof, you know? So although it's maybe a little more complicated than that because, you know, there's angles involved and basically the thing has to sort of bend, for lack of a better, kind of like my mudroom does. I don't know if you ever noticed it, but the garage is at an angle to the house, and that mudroom and the bathroom above it is literally bent in the middle in order to do that. So it'll be kind of like that, except the opposite way. And if that is the case, I could conceivably have a weather-tight shell, which is my goal, by the end of the year. This year.
Okay.
Which would then mean that, you know, I'm probably over a year from, like I wouldn't start building the layout immediately. That winter, I would probably do it the following winter or maybe the following fall into winter, because there's a lot of design that needs to be done. I need to relocate the Dartmouth Locomotive Works install thing into the new building and get that all set up and running. And since locos keep coming in all the time, you can't really be down for any length of time with it, or you just, you know, your backlog will choke you to death. So I think what I would do is build the new install area and then just basically take a day and transfer all of the tools and soldering irons and what have you over there, and I'd be up and running pretty quickly as a transition. My goal would be to move my milling machine out of my workshop into that spot, move the blasting booth out of that spot, move the paint booth into that spot, and basically have everything related to locomotive and freight car construction all located in one area, basically within roll around reach from one another. That would be such a boon, you can't imagine, because it's all over the place right now.
Sure.
And that would also leave me much more room in the workshop for, woodworking kind of things, keeping it, for anything that makes dust. And it takes all of that stuff that's in the basement right now out of there, so it opens up almost a quarter of my basement for development. So, it's not a project that just gets me the portion of the new building where there will be layout in it, and that's only about half of it, by the way.
Right.
But it also gets me a quarter of my basement. So it's like a significant, it's almost like a half a basement worth of space that's going to result from this. That's significant.
Have you figured out what the impact is on that kind of corner of your basement that will have to be
Layout kaboomed.
layout kaboomed? Yeah.
There will be zero impact on anything that has scenery. I also think there will be almost no impact on about 99% of what I've done so far. Naturally, if you're going to be changing some directions and going out into another room, there's going to be some changes to existing track work. So, for example, my staging yard, which is right now split 50-50, four tracks north, four tracks south, and there are two distinct tracks to get to it. My current plan is to have the southern staging yard representing Allentown out in the new building underneath whatever layout gets built out there, which will then double the amount of staging capacity that exists on the north end by using the whole thing for Sayer.
Okay.
So in order to do that, I'm basically going to route one track into the new building and put in a turnout so you can go to either side of the existing staging yard. So it's pretty minor actually. The other thing that would change a lot in that corner of the basement is it gives me the ability to really start thinking about how I would model the Pocono Northeast. And that's really what comes off from Pittston Yard and kind of curves around towards the aisle, and then it's going to circle back towards the entrance, of the currently the entrance to the basement. So I have a feeling that's going to extend somewhat into the new building as well. I saw the possibilities in modeling the PNE when we were down there last year, and we spent that really nice day with Tony V, who is the Reading and Northern engineer that's been so helpful to me in arranging a lot of the special access that I need to take photos on my line. And we're arranging right now another excellent day with Tony V coming up in June. He's going to show me what happens south of Pittston. We're going to follow the Lehigh line down probably as far as Hazleton. I want to see what that whole coal hauling area looks like and how it hits me from a modeling perspective, and I want to see what is in between there and Pittston. It's a great deal of things. There's industrial parks, there's all kinds of industries. So I want to see all of that and just see what grabs me from a modeling perspective. And be thinking about the design of all of this. And that's another reason I'm not going to rush it.
So, have you thought about what you're going to do after that?
I'm thinking, motorized wheelchair.
You'll need some way to get around, right?
Well, the whole property is designed so that you can roll your way into any part of it.
We can always count on you for some ambitious project, and just when I thought the dust had settled. here we go again. So, this is great, Mike, and look forward.
It keeps me motivated and fresh and interested. And obviously, you can't, expand forever. This is basically a one-shot deal,
Sure.
because I'll run out of life, if you to try to keep doing it. But
Yeah.
I think this will hold me. This is my. I think I mentioned it to you. I just was thinking about how do you want the next, say, 20 years to go.
Yeah.
Ideally. And you know what? If you don't have some sense of what that would be, it's not going to happen accidentally.
No, it won't. It's going to happen one way or another. It's your choice if you want to control it.
I'd like to have some say in it.
Yep, I agree. Mike, thank you for the update. Well, folks, there you have it. It was a busy weekend for us, and Mike's obviously well into the planning process for this new edition, so we look forward to updates as usual.
And we will probably next convene again sometime later on in July. July is going to be a crazy month for us. I know I have all manner of family visits planned for that, and I do have an op session, the next one, planned for the very end of that month. So it's going to be a busy time, but yep, we will no doubt have something interesting to talk about before that month is up.
So check back in with us, folks, and thanks for listening.
See you then.